You're listening to the Seasteading Today podcast, where we speak to entrepreneurs and researchers who are making the dream of seasteading a reality. The Seasteading Today podcast. Stop arguing and start seasteading.
Hello, Seasteaders. We have a wonderful and timely guest on the podcast today, Dr. Mary Ruart. Dr. Ruart is a research scientist, ethicist, and a libertarian author and activist. She has a PhD in biophysics and worked as a senior research scientist developing new therapies for a variety of diseases. She serves as chair for Liberty International and secretary of the Foundation for a Free Society. She is the author of Healing Our World and Death by Regulation, and I hope to talk a lot about her book, Death by Regulation, today. Welcome, Dr. Ruart.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here.
So can you tell us, first of all, when did you first hear about seasteading?
Quite a long time ago. 20 years, 30 years, maybe. I think I probably heard about it early in its inception.
And tell us a bit about what it means to have been developing new therapies. Is it correct to say you were researching new drugs to treat disease?
Yes, I was with the Upjohn Company for 19 years after my postdoctoral work in surgery. So I have a broad background in a variety of things in the sciences. And they brought me in to work with prostaglandins, and which was where they're called eicosanoids now. And your listeners might know of them indirectly. They are the products that you get from taking fish oil. So if you're taking fish oil supplements, you're doing so to create anti-inflammatory prostaglandins or eicosanoids. Anyhow, so that was one of the things. I worked with prostaglandins and liver disease, and we may talk about that in reference to death by regulation at some point. And we also looked at HIV protease inhibitors when the AIDS epidemic happened. And throughout all of this, I realized that it was very tough to get a drug from the lab bench to the marketplace because the FDA kept changing the regulations and the process was very long. And so after I left the Upjohn Company, I started to realize there were many, many publications out there that showed that the FDA was really doing a lot of damage if you put them all together. But because they were separate, no one was doing that. And so I decided I'd do that, and the result was the book Death by Regulation, How We Were Robbed of a Golden Age of Health and How We Can Reclaim It.
So are there some common misconceptions about the method or the process for developing new drugs?
Yes, a lot of people think that the FDA tests drugs. They do not. What they do is they tell the pharmaceutical companies what tests they must run, and then that material is sent to the FDA. And it's quite literally a truckload if you actually print it out. Of course, today it's all sent electronically, but back when I was in the industry, we literally loaded up a truck with paper to send to the FDA. And this is because it takes, these days it takes somewhere, depending on the drug, between 12 and 14 years to get a drug from the lab bench to the marketplace. So there's a lot of studies going on. And most of this time is due to the 1962 amendments to the Food and Drug Act, which were passed, obviously, in 1962. And before that time, it only took about 4 years for a drug to get from the lab bench to the marketplace. So we've added almost a decade of extra studies. And surprisingly enough, there is no increase in safety. And there's very little, if any, increase in effectiveness in our current list of drugs. And yet, because of this delay and the loss of innovation that happens, because, of course, when you're working on something that long, your costs go up. So you lose the possibility of working on other drugs because of all these things. The FDA's probably shaved 5 to 10 years off each of our lives.
Yes. So you make a very compelling argument and describe all of the details around how these amendments have created, in general, a worse environment for healthcare in the United States. And And so I guess let's start with, I have a list of questions to ask about this and all the different permutations of that. I think in general, when I'm talking to people about regulation and you know, seasteading in particular, to get beyond existing systems of regulation, it's kind of hard to explain what is so detrimental about these added regulations and, you know, what is so detrimental about all that paperwork you described. And it really is death by a thousand paper cuts, because it really is in the details. It's all of the minutes that add up in trying to follow the rules and even just understand the rules, that stifles innovation and stifles creativity and costs a lot of money. And so you do go into a lot of great detail about that in Death by Regulation. And so I guess my first question is, so the amendments, one major change that they added to the FDA regulations is that the new drugs have to demonstrate effectiveness. And so what are some of the consequences of that requirement?
Well, the FDA chose a very tough standard. They said you had to have, initially at least, they said you had to have two studies done in the United States. They wouldn't accept data from overseas initially. And that those studies had to have what we call a statistical significance of 0.05, which means that for each study, there was only a 5% chance that the effectiveness that you saw was a mistake. And that's a pretty strict standard. And the problem with that is it creates a huge burden. And it's such a strong burden, not only on cost in terms of dollars, but in terms of time, that many companies don't develop drugs that could be life-saving. And I'll give you a good example. We talked earlier a little bit about my work with prostaglandins and liver disease, and it came to the attention of the FDA. And so one of the examiners actually called me up, and they were so excited about this patent because they wanted the Upjohn company to develop a prostaglandin for the treatment of liver disease, because there really was nothing else to treat. You know, at that point in time, 100,000 people were dying every year from cirrhotic liver disease or fibrosis of the liver, scarring of the liver, if you will. And there was really no treatment other than bed rest. But the problem is this: when you are doing something new that no one's ever done before, you don't know the dose of the drug you have to give. You don't know how many times a day you have to give it. You don't know how long you have to give it for. You know, liver disease, terminal liver disease is really, it takes a long time, years to happen. And, you know, we thought it might take years to reverse it. So we didn't even know how long we had to treat. Well, if you guess wrong on any of these things, your study will not have the statistical significance that the FDA requires. And what we realized, if we had to start over because we guessed wrong, which we probably would initially, then by the time our drug actually made it to market, it would be off patent. And the problem with that is, you can't recover the current level of drug development costs without having a patent. And this was not true when I first joined the company, by the way. We did develop drugs without patents, but because of the increasing costs, which increase every year exponentially, of getting an FDA approval, we can't develop drugs anymore without a patent. And so we didn't develop it because we realized that we probably couldn't put this new life-saving drug on the market before our patent ran out, given all the restrictions that the FDA had, even though it was encouraging us to do it. And and this is why a lot of life-saving innovations are still on the laboratory shelf and not in the marketplace, because it's very, very hard to bring something new to the market.
Sure. And so I think in general, people, they're afraid of snake oil salesmen, or they're afraid of drugs that are going to have severe side effects. And I think overall, the argument in Death by Regulation is that the FDA is not ensuring that drugs are not snake oil, or that it's not actually going to have side effects. Is that accurate to say?
Well, yes, actually, snake oil was probably very beneficial because because it actually it contains the building blocks of these prostaglandins, just like fish oil does, right? Snake oil has it too. So this was probably great if you weren't taking your cod liver oil back then. But but be that as it may, here's what the data shows. So before the amendments were passed, the FDA withdrew about 2.5% of all the drugs it approved because of safety reasons. And after the amendments were passed, they withdrew more drugs, 3.3%. Now, these numbers probably aren't really different, but 3.3% is higher than 2.5%. And, you know, the promise of the amendments is that that number would be lower. That didn't happen. In addition, it turns out that the marketplace was already weeding out the ineffective drugs. There were studies done after the amendments were passed, and the highest number of ineffective drugs that was ever found, and I think there were three studies, was about 10% ineffective drugs. Well, you know, obviously you'd like to get rid of that, but actually none of the drugs on the market today are effective for everyone. You know, it's how you define effectiveness. None of them are effective for everyone. And so, you know this if you're a patient because, you know, your doctor put you on one blood medication, a blood pressure medication, it has side effects or it's not working. So he transfers you to another and then another till the right mix is found, you know, because we're all different. So there really isn't such thing as, it's not easy to define effectiveness is what I'm saying. And in some cases, a small number of patients, maybe 10% would find their lives saved by these drugs, but it won't show up in these statistical studies that the FDA has you doing because it's such a small group. In fact, the NIH is now going back and looking at all the clinical studies to find these little subgroups because people are waking up to the fact that the way the FDA asks the drug companies to do the studies are not the best way to do them. And so the marketplace had already taken care of most ineffective drugs. So these regulations were totally unnecessary. And they've increased the cost of what we pay at the pharmacy about 800%. So it's a really bad trade-off to get rid of 10% of the ineffective drugs. And so consumers are paying these big prices at the pharmacy and not realizing that it's due to the cost of getting an FDA approval going up exponentially every year.
Sure. Well, and I think that's an interesting concept. It seems like we want to have a very clear outline of like, you have X disease, you take this medication and you'll be better in this at this time. And it's just human bodies don't work that way. We're all too different. We have different lifestyles and diets and other medications. And so, I mean, what's a reasonable expectation for a new drug?
Well, that's a good question. And there's not an easy answer because every drug is effective in some people. And that's because of the placebo effect. So if your doctor tells you this drug is going to cure you, there will be somewhere between probably 10% and 30% of the patients that will get well, even though he's handing them a sugar pill. And, you know, this confounds, of course, all of our studies. So the FDA tries to get us to run a study against placebo or against the what we call standard of care treatment, which is, you know, it's okay, but still it's not a guarantee for the individual patient. Only some patients will benefit. The numbers I've seen are something like 50% of the patients will benefit by any particular drug. And for cancer drugs, that may be a lot less, actually. But for the normal everyday drug, you'll find about 50% effectiveness. And, you know, I'm not sure at this point in our knowledge of science, we can do better than that. In fact, most of the safety problems we have are because we cannot predict doing animal studies and a few human studies, you know, what the entire safety profile is going to be. It's only after many, many people take them with different genetics, different eating habits and things like that, that we find out, you know, that some people are more susceptible than others to side effects.
So is there a method for collecting that information on drugs once they're out in the market? Like, how does that get How does that information get internalized in the drug company?
Yes, there's lots of different things that happen. There are reporting systems in place that, you know, where physicians, when they're using a new drug and they see a side effect they didn't expect, they report in on it. So there are those. Also, there are reviews by doctors and that they publish in journals using these products and saying, well, this doesn't seem to be happening right, or this is happening better than we thought, or whatever their experience is. And there are journals that specialize in this type of thing. Prior to the amendments, the American Medical Association actually ran their own tests. And third-party testing is a really good thing because, as I say, the FDA doesn't do any testing. They just tell the companies which tests they have to do. And obviously, you know, that could lead to some bias, if you will. Third-party testing is always the best. And that kind of ended when the FDA got its teeth in 1962. There still are consumer groups, however, who predict which drugs will be approved and which ones are going to be withdrawn from the market. The Abigail Alliance, for example, studies cancer drugs, and they have urged the FDA to approve 40 different drugs over their, I think, maybe 20 years of existence. And what they do is they've been able to predict which drugs should be marketed an average of 2 years before the FDA actually approves them, which means that cancer patients whose lives could be saved by these drugs are not getting access to them for 2 years, way past the time when a consumer's group can tell that they're effective. And Public Citizen, although I'm not a big fan of a lot of the stuff they do something, they predict which medicines are going to be pulled from the market or have serious safety problems, and they're right 50% of the time. So that's pretty impressive.
So when you said third-party testing, immediately my little antenna went up like, oh, maybe that could be a good business on a seastead to do some third-party testing of medications.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, actually, you can, if the drug is approved in the country you're working in, of course, you can do your own studies if you want to, although you have to jump through some hoops to, get approval and everything. But yes, that would be definitely something that could happen. Also, there are treatments that are available in some countries and not in others. Those would be a great target for seasteading. And then, of course, there's these drugs that exist, but for whatever reason, haven't been FDA approved or approved by the regulatory community in general. So there's no approval anywhere. But in theory, one could try to treat with those drugs. Obviously, there are patent considerations and maybe negotiations with a company that would need to be done. And of course, the problem with that is that a regulatory agency like the FDA would frown on going around them like that. And so the companies tend not to want to do that. In fact, that's part of the problem with the current right to try legislation, is that some companies are going to be very hesitant to let their unapproved drugs be used by people, even if they desperately need them, because they're afraid the FDA is going to get angry at them and drag their feet. This is another thing that the public doesn't know, is that the FDA really has power to make or break companies. And so they tend to do what the FDA wants them to do for fear that the FDA will select them for the punishment of dragging their feet on an approval. And it really makes a big difference who gets first to market. The first to market company will, you know, gain most of the market pretty much immediately. And the second to market company will have a small fraction of that. So, you know, it's really a big deal.
So, you mentioned drugs that get approved in other countries. So I know that there is some medical tourism. People travel from countries where their medical procedures are more expensive to get treatment in countries where they're less expensive. And we expected seasteading to offer a lot to medical tourists. But if a drug is approved in another country and a patient travels from the United States to get that drug treatment, does that harm that drug company's reputation with the FDA?
It depends if it's the same company. You know, the way this goes is usually there are multiple companies working on very similar chemical versions of a drug to treat a disease. So let's say a drug is approved in Europe, but not in the US. If they are trying to get into the US market, it's not a problem if people go to Europe to get it. Obviously, the FDA can't control that. And I would think that if they went to a ship, a seasteading ship that had those drugs available, again, I don't think, you know, the company can't control that. So as long as the purchase of by the seasteading ship was made in a legal environment, I don't think it would be a problem.
Okay. So when we're talking about medical care on a seastead, do you have any advice for, you know, how to set up a system where medical providers are accountable? You know, I think some people jump to the worst conclusions when they hear that seasteaders want to be free of regulations. They assume that seasteaders want to do terrible human experimentation or other unethical things. But so how do we set up medical care that is ethical and accountable, but also takes into account that you can't always predict with 100% accuracy if a drug is going to be effective? Mm-hmm. And how do you maintain certain levels of safety? Like what's reasonable to expect with levels of safety?
Well, obviously, if the drug is approved in other countries, you can point to that approval. And there probably are studies, published studies, that have been done on that drug that you can point to. So it's pretty easy if the drug's approved elsewhere. Now, if it's a totally unapproved drug or totally unapproved treatment, you know, things get a little tougher. But one place that this really makes a huge difference is stem cell research. And I'm not talking about fetal stem cells now. I'm talking about adult stem cells. For example, what happened in the U.S. is there was a doctor in Colorado who was, you know, doing some amazing things with athletes. You know, if they had an injury, he was able to use stem cells to treat them instead of having a normal surgery that would keep them out for much longer. And what he found is that elderly people and diabetics that he used these procedures on needed a higher concentration of stem cells. So he developed a process to grow them up in a test tube, so to speak. And then because he had grown up the person's own stem cells, they didn't have any problem with rejection, but they did have a lot of stem cells, and now their injuries often could be repaired. By injuries, I don't just mean athletic type injuries, but injuries that comes with old age, such as arthritis and things of that nature. And then the FDA said, wait a minute, you can't do that. If you grow the stem cells up in a test tube and then inject them back into a person, those stem cells are drugs. If you do the procedure on the same day, they aren't. So he basically had to move all of his stem cell research that included growing these stem cells up in great concentrations for diabetics and elderly, he had to go offshore. So here is where seasteading comes in, because of course a seasteading ship could have such stem cell treatments. And I think in those cases, people are going to be less concerned about potential side effects because it's their own cells, correct? So, you know, the danger, just the kind of danger you have with a drug just isn't there. You have the danger of an injection, obviously. And these are, you know, these aren't like the kind of injection you might get for an antibiotic. These are more serious injections. So in that sense, that technique might cause some concern, but of course those techniques are well worked out. So it's just really your own stem cells. If you want to get your own stem cells, I see a lot of people wanting to do that on a seasteading ship. I think that is a major, major area where seasteading could really make a huge difference, because scientists could work on it there, and you know, it could be given to patients there, and it could really change the whole course of what we're able to do with the human body. This is a very powerful technique.
Sure. Well, and would that provide data that would then maybe persuade the FDA to allow those treatments in the United States?
Probably not.
Okay.
The research, yes. I mean, obviously, the people who are doing such work overseas where they can do it should be publishing it. And those would, those, of course, are a great incentive for patients to go somewhere and get those treatments. But the FDA has very specific things they want done. And they want it done in a very specific way. And, they have lots of baby steps, shall I say. When you're using a technique like stem cells, that doesn't really work. And the reason is that you do it in one patient and you realize that maybe that patient, because of their condition, should have gotten more stem cells. In other words, you're not getting the results you expected. So the next time you do a patient like that, you give more stem cells. Well, you see, to make a change like that, that's a major change in your protocol. And it means that you've got to jump through some more hoops to make that change. And so this is why I don't think that what happens in the seasteading area would be good enough for an FDA approval unless there was a great public clamor for it. I mean, the FDA is a political body. And so, if it could, pressure can be brought to bear. So, I mean, that could happen. But usually the FDA wants its own process followed. And if its process isn't followed, it doesn't believe anything works.
Right.
So, that's just the way it is.
Well, it also makes me think of, you talk about vitamins and supplements and these things that cannot be patented, basically. And that I think you tell a couple different stories where, you ask a patient asked for some help for a new drug that you were working on or that you knew someone was working on. And you were told that vitamin E does the same thing. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact disease.
Lazaroids. Yes. We called them Lazaroids because they seemed to do everything but raise someone from the dead, right? These compounds are really potent. And I did get asked by a gentleman if he could get some of it. It wasn't on the market yet. So I asked the project manager and he said, we can't give him the drug, but just tell him to take a lot of vitamin E. It'll do the same thing. So Upjohn made vitamin E. So why weren't we marketing vitamin E? Well, we weren't because we couldn't make a health claim for vitamin E, a disease claim, and say, hey, this could be helpful in X disease without jumping through this, 12 to 14 year process that the FDA set up. And if we had done that, of course, our data, the drug would be totally generic the first day it went on the market, basically, and unless we could find some clever way to tweak it chemically, which is what we did with the Lazaroids, right? So, it's really, the FDA has really shifted our whole medical paradigm from prevention to treatment. It's very hard to talk about prevention and not have the FDA come down on you. In fact, there were very many health care centers and supplement manufacturers and even doctors that would treat their patients with supplements if they could. They had their places raided by an FDA SWAT team back in the 80s. And it was really scary. And it wasn't until a couple of freedom-loving founders of Life Extension Foundation finally defeated the FDA in court. They had brought coenzyme Q10 into the United States. It's a natural product that your body makes. But the FDA said they had brought in an illegal drug because the Japanese were selling it as a prescription drug. So it took them 8 years to fight it. And their attorneys kept saying, you've got to settle. You've got to feel. You got to go to prison. It's going to happen. The FDA doesn't get defeated. Well, the founders of Life Extension fought and they won. And it's a good thing, too, because coenzyme Q is what most doctors in the know prescribe to their patients when they're taking statins. And that's because the statins, which are one of the most popular drugs in the country for lowering cholesterol, it's actually really an anti-inflammatory. That's probably how it works. So many people are taking statins that couldn't take them if they didn't have coenzyme Q because the side effects are countered by coenzyme Q. And that's because your body, to detoxify this drug, has to use your body's coenzyme Q, and it depletes it, and that causes a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, you know, there's a lot of criticism of supplements or alternative medicine and all of that. And the critics usually say this isn't approved by the FDA. And, you know, you mentioned at one point in Death by Regulation that researchers know that if they're testing a medication for a certain disease, they can often restrict the diet of the test animal, so that there's it seems like it's scientific. There's a scientific method to knowing removing a certain vitamin protein or whatever. If you remove that from their diet, you will cause a disease.
That's right.
So it sounds like there's like a science that it's not unscientific to say, you know, supplementing with that nutritional supplement will also counter the disease.
Yes, you're very right. You know, back when, of course, I was working the olden days before we had genetic manipulation, right? So in order to study a disease, we had to have a sick animal, but our animals weren't sick. Our rats kind of were pretty healthy up to the point they died. And so the way we created disease models was we took away one of their vitamins. For example, if you take away choline from the diet, you can get a liver disease that looks a lot like alcoholic liver disease. And part of the reason for that is that alcohol depletes choline, is very similarly to the way that statins decrease the coenzyme Q in the body. So what we would do to create a disease model is we would take away a particular vitamin, depending on what kind of disease we wanted to produce. So the researchers at the Upjohn company were going, oh boy, this suggests that optimal nutrition is very important in protecting your health. So we all took supplements and exercise, kept our weight down, didn't smoke, didn't drink. You know, it's really hard actually to get rats to drink. They're too smart to do that. You have to put chocolate in their liquid diet to get them to drink alcohol. If you put it in their water, they'll literally let themselves thirst to death before they'll drink the alcoholic water. So that just goes to show you animals sometimes are a lot smarter than we are. But it was interesting because while the researchers were doing all this to protect themselves from disease, the medical doctors who didn't see really what we had seen, that taking vitamins out of the diet creates disease, you know, they didn't take these precautions. And you could kind of tell who had the MD and who had the PhD by looking at the different people. And I have to say, of course, there were exceptions. That there were several medical doctors that, you know, were reading the reports of the scientists and going, oh yeah, must be important to have good nutrition. But for the most part, that wasn't the case.
And we didn't talk much about it, but is there anything about the response to COVID-19 that reveals weaknesses in our regulatory system?
Oh, yes. I think the FDA did us a huge disservice and is responsible for many thousands of deaths from COVID. What they did is, you know, we knew this was coming for some time. And as our innovative private companies were gearing up to provide us test kits, the FDA came out in, early February and said, only the CDC's tests can be used. No other tests will be allowed. In other words, they created a monopoly on the test. Well, the CDC couldn't produce enough test kits. And when it found, and when they did produce some, what they found out is their test didn't work. And the FDA did not back off on this. It would not allow us to import test kits either. So we really, until mid-March, we really were not allowed to use other tests. Once the FDA finally lifted the ban, of course, we started importing tests. Our at-home companies made tests. And the reason this is so important is that the way you stop a disease is to find out who the carriers are and quarantine them. You don't quarantine the whole society, but that's exactly all we were left with. Because in addition to having all these restrictions on tests, there were similar restrictions on protective gear. So our hospital workers were sometimes using disposable masks, and they were reusing them because they didn't have any others. And again, they couldn't import them. There were similar restrictions. Finally, the FDA lifted that as well. And then A similar thing happened with hand sanitizer. Of course, the stores ran out very quickly. And the whiskey distillers said, hey, we can provide enough hand sanitizer for the whole country. We'll make it out of drinking alcohol. And the FDA said, wait, nope, can't do that. Because if you do that, you must poison the hand sanitizer that you're making, because this is drinking alcohol. Somebody might try to drink it. So you've got to put poison in it so they don't drink it. The problem was, if they did that, the manufacturers might not be able to reuse their machinery because it wasn't really clear if they'd be able to clean it well enough or not. And finally, I think the FDA decided to look the other way. I've seen a lot of alcohol-based ethyl alcohol as opposed to isopropanol or isopropyl alcohol out there that doesn't seem to have been had this poison in. And thankfully, the FDA is ignoring that and not prosecuting them to the best of my knowledge. So the FDA really stopped us from getting tests, protective gear, and hand sanitizer. That's why social distancing and shutting down the economy was all that was left. And it's devastating because people are going to go back to their jobs and find out in many cases that they don't have a job because these small businesses that have been shut down, they don't have a huge reserve. They can't survive this in many cases, and that means the jobs are gone. And when you consider that small businesses are the ones that supply 60% of the jobs in this country, you realize that a lot of people are going to lose their jobs. And when they lose their jobs, the deaths from just the stress, the poor health care, suicides of that group of people who have lost their jobs or are become underemployed is going to increase dramatically. This is not a cost-free process. People will die because of this shutdown.
Sure. Well, and we have talked a little bit about if we were in a seasteading community, how would we manage a pandemic or a contagious disease like this? And you know, some of the countries that seem to have flattened the curve most effectively, it seems like you have to sacrifice a lot of your privacy so that the government can track who's infected and all that. Do you think that's a necessary trade-off, that in order to stop an infectious disease, you would have to give up your privacy?
Not necessarily, because I think most people would cooperate with something like that. I mean, if I were a carrier, I certainly wouldn't want to be infecting other people. And I think that the people I know that I might have associated with would feel the same way. Now, obviously, you know, the government would be checking things out with a variety of different people. I think that most people would feel comfortable with that, you know, because they'd want to help their neighbors and not spread the disease. But, you know, there might be some people who'd balk at that. And I'm not really sure that it would make a huge difference because, frankly, when we have something like this, really, it's up to us as individuals to take the precautions we need in order to make sure we don't get it. To give you an example, when I was younger, you know, I got measles when I was a child, and in those days, females especially tried to get measles when they were children because they didn't want to have it when they were pregnant. And a pregnant woman who had not had measles as a child, they took precautions to protect their child. They stayed home. They wore a mask when they went out. You know, so that's really our personal responsibility. Our own health is our personal responsibility. So if we are in a vulnerable group, it's up to us to say, okay, I'm going to stay at home. I'm going to wear a mask. I'm going to do whatever I need to do to protect myself. It's not reasonable to expect that other people should be responsible for protecting you. Because if we have that situation, you know, it's impossible really to make that work.
Where can people find you and find your books and learn more about this topic?
Well, the best place to go is my website, ruart.com, ruwart.com. And if you go to the lower right-hand corner of the homepage, you'll see links to all of my social media and YouTube. And of course, I have a free library where you can go and read the 1993 edition of Healing Our World, which is probably still the most extensive compilation of how liberty works in the real world. So that's something that they can get there. I have some of my videos there as well. And of course, you can buy my books if you like there, and including the 2015 edition of Healing Our World, which is probably going to be its last edition. And of course, Death by Regulation and Short Answers to the Tough Questions, based on a column I wrote for the Advocates for Self-Government for about 20 years.
Well, anything else you'd like to add to the, any advice to give to seasteaders as we wrap up here?
I would really think seasteaders would do well to take on stem cell research as a major project. This is where the future is. And this is something that is being held back, certainly in the United States and some other countries, for stupid regulatory reasons. Again, it uses the patient's own cells. So, you know, the actual risk of, you know, reactions like the type you'd get with drugs and everything are minimal. And so this is a very important future thing that the seasteading world could change, really, virtually overnight by taking that on as a project. So I'd really suggest some consideration there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
You're welcome. And I wish a good day to you and all of your listeners.
This episode of the Seasteading Today podcast is sponsored by Atlantis Sea Colony. The purpose of Atlantis Sea Colony is to bring the undersea world to the masses through hotels, habitats, private homes, and industrial and corporate facilities. A big thank you to Brendan Traxler and Adam Jewell of the Atlantis Sea Colony for supporting this podcast and for having me on their podcast, which is called Colonize the Ocean. You can listen to the Colonize the Ocean podcast on Spotify and YouTube. To learn more about Atlantis Sea Colony, visit AtlantisSeaColony.com. That's AtlantisSeaColony.com. If you would like to sponsor a future episode of the Seasteading Today podcast, visit give.seasteading.org/podcast sponsor. Thank you.
The Seasteading Today podcast is produced by John Bush. Your host is Carly Jackson. Send feedback and questions to podcast@seasteading.org. To support the podcast and the Seasteading mission, go to seasteading.org/donate. If you'd like to learn more, read the book, Seasteading: How Floating Nations Will Restore the Environment, Enrich the Poor, Cure the Sick, and Liberate Humanity from Politicians. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed, and we'll save you a spot on a seastead.